Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast. It's me.
Hi.
Hello.
It's me, Dave Etler. I'm here with Amy Young.
Hi.
I'm here with Taz Khalid.
Hello again.
Did I do that right?
Yes.
Okay.
It's fine.
I'm here with... What does that even mean?
Taz is fine.
All right, Taz. I'm here with...
We don't have to call you your full name every time?
Yeah, he's like...
Well, Taz Khalid. Urtiza. What do you think?
He's like Madonna.
Madonna. Just Taz.
I'm here with Matt Becker.
Hello.
And Mark Terrell.
Yeah.
Hi, Mark.
What up?
I feel like I haven't seen you in ages.
Yeah, it's...
I feel like I haven't seen any of you in ages.
Anyway. It's quiet on campus right now, though.
It is. It's spring break. I should point out that spring break at Iowa falls on match week. So match day is tomorrow. So by the time our listeners hear
right
this,
after
it'll be
St.
Like,
Patrick's Day.
It'll be like almost a week ago. Yes. Perfect.
I mean, think of that.
It's St. Patrick's Day today. Anyway, match day is tomorrow, which is exciting. I think it's the more exciting day. Like if you compared graduation with match day, it's... There's no contest. Match day is way more.
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. Graduation is more for your parents.
Yeah.
Match day, or you know, your families.
Your Facebooks.
Your match day is more for like you and your, you know,
your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So very exciting tomorrow at. For those who you know aren't medical students, earlier this week, Monday, the fourth years found out whether they matched or not, and some people inevitably have to go through the supplemental offer and acceptance program, which is used to be called the scramble. That's where they didn't match and they need to find a position. So that's finished. And tomorrow, everybody gets to find out where they matched. So I don't know.
Do you guys know how the match works, right?
Somewhat.
Kind of,
yeah. It's really weird. Yeah, it's really weird, actually. They how it works is you interview at programs and you'll rank the programs in the order that you like them. And they also rank their candidates in the order. And then there's a really complex algorithm that's used that was actually, I believe it was written and designed by a Nobel Prize winning economist.
He won the Nobel Prize because of his work.
Right.
Did he go here or did he just recently speak here?
He spoke
here last year, and I really wish we could have gotten him on the show because it was actually really interesting how, you know, the psychological, I mean, this is math, and yet, you know, it's also, he's an economics
guru.
He's sitting him down and being like, how does it feel to know that all medical students across the country hate you?
Well, what's really funny is, I wish every medical student could have seen it because they used to do it a certain way. The algorithm used to be a certain way that favored the programs, the residency programs. In other words, they
were given more weight.
They were given
individual.
More weight. Their choices were given more weight. And then medical students, you know, whined and cried like they always do. No, I'm just kidding. Medical students, you know, that wasn't cool. There was a lack of trust in that arrangement, so they flipped it so that medical students' choices have more weight.
Are you okay?
I don't know. I'm going to leave that in.
Do we need a doctor?
The ghost of match day.
So,
or St. Patrick's Day. There's all sorts of things. So
too much St. Patty's Day. I've forgotten how to breathe.
Dave felt a chill run over his body. He was lifted like 3 feet into the air.
His life flashed before his eyes.
Oh, God. I try to be all serious, and where does it get me?
The match finds your lack of faith.
I think that
disturbing.
Was an AMSA initiative, actually.
Was it? I don't remember.
To help get the match algorithm more in the favor of the students.
Oh.
I think.
But, yeah, it was all like the whole, all of the thought processes around this algorithm are around trust. So anyway, it's really interesting, and you know, you're gonna end up reading about it anyway. If you're like a pre-med or whatever, go read about it now. It's really fascinating. I thought it was really fascinating when he came and talked. And again, I wish I could have had him on the show, and you guys could have beaten him up. But yeah, he seemed like a nice guy.
Sure,
he's doing his best. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, today's show, I should mention, is brought to you by the Weenus.
Is it?
Oh, man.
This is my son. My son taught me this term yesterday.
And the weenus said, and the elbow pit. So
he said to me something. He was like, have you ever heard of the weenus? And I'm like,
don't you ever use that word ever again.
I'm pretty sure Casey has used that word like on 4 or 5 separate shows.
I don't know.
You go back and listen. I
don't remember it, but I remember.
Yeah, because she has this whole thing where she talks about
the
weenus.
Well, wait, don't
give away. Okay, okay.
So, my son, you know, said this to me yesterday. And I said something about, he said, do you know what a weenus is? And I'm like, you just made that up. You just made that word up. Because like, he's a potty mouth.
Right.
All kids are.
We're all potty mouths in my family. But anyway, and he's like, no, it's basically the skin on your elbow. And I'm like, that is bullshit. You totally made that up. He's like, no, it's real. And I looked it up, and it is, in fact, a thing.
Yeah.
The word, this is according to
WebMD.
Urban Dictionary.
Answers.reference.com and localhealth.com. The word weenus is viewed as an odd name for the extra skin around the elbow. The slang is not medical terminology. There are no origins known for this word. A rash on this area of the elbow can be caused by a number of reasons. It may be an indication of something around the actual elbow. Blah, 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 blah. But anyway, skin around the elbow. So, I was a little, you know, when I heard this term, I'm like, this could be cause for, you know, confusion in the doctor's office. Because if a patient came in and said, my weenus hurts.
Right.
Right, yeah.
I mean, you could jump to a completely different conclusion if you didn't know.
Urology.
Right. So I'm, again, once again, the Short Code Podcast is here to provide you with
a
service.
Neither did I.
So you just found out about this yourself, you said?
Well, Mark says that she's used this term before on the show.
He's heard it. I don't think he's really, like, taken it in.
I haven't
thought about it. Yeah. Looked at it come out of his child's mouth.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, who are you to say I have excess skin around my elbow?
We all do. Yeah. It's part of being human.
We all do.
This is why it's a radio show.
I never thought about it.
So Dave just wiggled his weenus, so...
Can confirm.
Yeah.
Are you guys going to sign the big petition? This is the push by some medical students at Harvard and elsewhere to eliminate the Step 2 clinical skills exam for U.S. medical graduates. So, again, for our listeners who aren't in med school yet, the U.S. medical licensing exam has as a part of it step two. So you take step one. That's your scientific knowledge, which, you know, a lot of people, just except for Taz apparently, think is a good thing. And
I will talk about that in a while. Let you finish first.
All right. So, and then step two is where you go to one of what, like 5 cities, basically, mm-hmm. around the country, and you take a test in which you interact with an actor who's playing a patient with a condition, and your job is to demonstrate your clinical skills.
And it's to simulate like an average day in clinic. So you see, I think, like 8 patients back to back, and you have a certain time frame to write a note on them. And
mm-hmm. Yes. And that's exactly right. Many medical schools, so this came about in 2004, and in preparation for that, many medical schools created performance-based assessment programs like we have here, in which we bring in fake
simulated patients
yeah.
to for the students to interact
wow.
with and practice on.
Such
and,
a difference.
And it's weird. Actually worked for the PBA program when I first got here. It was very interesting. But anyway, point is that the existence of this test created basically the need for this new program to prepare students for this experience and all that kind of stuff. Well, these guys are like, no, this is expensive, it's ineffective, and it doesn't do anything. Well, it has no value. So the expense, you guys read this? The expense part of it, it costs about $1,200 just to take the test.
It's absurd how much it costs.
$1,275 just to take the test. That's not including the travel expenses to go to one of these, you know, few cities and take the test. It's not effective. They say, according to the
petition, there's no data to support a causal link between step two and improved patient outcomes. Mm. And they think these skills could be, you know, better evaluated within the medical school. And it costs about, according to the petition, I was surprised, it costs about $1 million to catch a single student who fails step two CS on back-to-back attempts.
A similar type of argument has been set forth for, like, the bar exam with law students. Mm-hmm.
Your husband's a lawyer.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
It's just, like, really expensive, and they, I think last year or the year before, they tried to say that any student graduating from a law school in the state of Iowa could practice in Iowa without taking the bar, but it didn't go through. But, I mean, the exam is really expensive. You spend an entire summer studying for it, and the pass rate's like 99%.
Right.
So you're weeding out a very small fraction, and then those that retake it usually pass, and my... My husband said it's totally worth like six exams. Like,
well,
he does nothing that he was on the bar exam.
Yeah, well, at least my understanding is at least step two seeks to simulate, you know, sort of everyday, you know, conditions and things like that.
Should we do a plug for the empathy exams book?
We could do that. We still have we are giving away empathy exams books to College of Medicine students. We have some left. Come and bring it. But that's part of this. The author, Leslie Jamison, who will be our featured presenter at the Examine Life Conference in October of 2016, was, in fact, a former standardized patient here. And so...
I did get one. Thank you. Sorry.
I have one. Thanks.
So if you want to learn more about it, this might be a good book to pick up. We've got some for college medicine students.
And she's a graduate of the Creators Writer. Creator Writers Workshop.
That's right. So there you go. I don't know how you guys feel about it. What do you guys think of this whole step two petition? I've talked enough.
I don't know. I'm kind of displaced from it right now, so I haven't really been thinking about it.
Yeah, you guys are MSTP. You and Amy are MSTP students.
We're kind of opposite ends of the graduate school spectrum. I just started.
And you guys are M1, so you're not quite there yet. But you will be soon. It won't be long.
I was going to say, from my own experiences at this point in time, I don't know about the cost expenses, but I would, like I said earlier, I would rather have the step two than the step one, and I'll get to why. But the step two in my head makes sense because you're talking to patients, like, well, fake patients and interacting with them, making sure what I did in the clinic
standardized
looks like.
Patients.
Standardized patients.
Let's be official test.
Sure.
That's what the show is all about.
I understand.
I agree. I think step two. So my biggest problem with it, based on that, is how much it costs. I think it costs way too much money for what it shows, but I think it's a useful evaluator. That's an important.
Couldn't you just have some sort of, like, tell medical schools to have some sort of internal metric that the students have to pass before they
you
graduate.
Could, but then you have to manage all the medical schools as opposed to just one standardized program.
I mean, in a way, they're doing that already because you have your accreditation
LCME
visits, which for the College of Medicine is coming up in not too long from now. So you know, like, there is some mechanism in place to evaluate.
I can understand their reasoning. I guess I just don't feel too strongly in either direction.
Well, I mean, if over 95% of U.S. medical students pass on their first attempt, then I guess you do have to question, you know, how useful the test is.
And I don't think the clinical skills are used. Like, if you rock your clinical skills portion, it doesn't mean anything. It's not like having a higher score but still passing on step one or two clinical knowledge, which is the multiple choice exam, where you'll actually get ranked higher at different programs if you have a better score on that. The clinical skills. So I guess that's another argument that
I think detracts
from its value.
I think the whole idea, though, is to weed out the bad
who
physicians.
Too late. Right. Well, too late. Yeah. At that point.
Yeah. Who can't talk to?
I don't
to,
think step two does that though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it may not.
I think they see it as another hurdle that should catch some people who got through that are not good with patients. I don't know.
And I'll say that the petition only mentions U.S. medical students, also what do they call them, international medical graduates, who come to the U.S. to get into residency. They have to take the exam currently as well, and I don't think that this petition applies to that. Because, you know, this foreigners, you can't trust them.
You sure about that?
America!
Oh, Taz, I didn't know you were there.
I was going to say, there's one in the room right now.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were there.
I am right here, right in front of you.
Right. So where are you from again, Taz?
Pakistan.
Yeah.
The good old land of Pakistan.
Yep. So... Nice.
I have to say, I have a general, my limited experience with standardized patients, I'm not really a huge fan. It's just all super awkward. not that seeing Amy, regular patients is not awkward.
Amy's facial expression really is what made that.
In what way is it super awkward?
Because they're bad, they're bad actors.
Edit.
Edit, we gotta edit that.
Let's walk it back just a tiny bit.
My second year of medical school, I had the crying or emotional standardized patient.
Okay.
And
are you sure that wasn't me?
You're not standardized. Yeah. You're fake.
That was just Dave last Wednesday. That was a typical Wednesday.
And I just stared at my notepad with this huge smile on my face the entire time, and I could not stop.
Yeah, but you see, that's the point. They're supposed to make you smiling? Awkward and feel
because,
better.
Because I could tell he was acting.
Oh,
yeah.
And, he was crying, but not really. And it was just all overwhelming. And so I just started laughing.
Do you think you could ever be an actress?
Yeah. Could you do better, Amy?
No. I'm just wondering if that's a barrier you have personally is acting. And that you're actually the one that can't fake it and make believe.
But he was actually really nice. He let me go through the whole thing with this giant smirk on my face. And then he's like, I'm going to cut you some slack because I just have a feeling you probably wouldn't have done that in real life.
But would you?
You mean when you're not fake crying?
I don't believe there's a checklist.
So, in real life, what would you do?
A patient starts crying. The whole time.
Smiles too much.
Yeah.
I mean, when I've done clinical connections as a grad student and I've worked in oncology clinic, I tear up when patients start crying.
Yeah.
But oncology clinic's really sad.
Yeah.
And, I think about my personal experience with my mom, and I empathize a lot.
Good.
And so I think that's why I'm going to go into pathology. I think I get too pulled in.
My wife cries. She's a cochlear implant researcher. She cries all the time at patients. I don't...
when they hear for the first time?
It doesn't matter. She cries. Yeah. She just cries.
I mean, I think it's part...
Maybe it's being married to me. I don't know.
Happy to.
I think it's... I mean, you have a relationship with just people by virtue of them. You're both human, and when someone's sad, it makes you sad.
I would probably be the same way, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely weirder to be the opposite. To not feel sad when someone's dying of cancer in front of you.
I think it just all falls in place when you're looking at a real patient. Mm-hmm. Here we know in the back of our heads that, this is a patient acting and they're not actually in pain or they're sad or...
And therefore, you're aware that you are also...
Right. Happened to me what Amy went through, but last semester we had a simulated patient before in class, and she was so good at her acting that she just asked me one question about, I asked her a question and she responded back with some answer regarding cats, and she just tore up in one sentence, and I was like, I don't know what else to say. I knew she's acting, but I couldn't respond to her answer.
Yeah, so it probably varies by the by the situation,
So here's the thing, I wouldn't call, that's why I feel like they shouldn't be called standardized patients, they should be called simulated patients because they're not standardized.
Well, they are, the ones that you saw are in fact called simulated patients is my understanding because I don't think it was an exam situation. You were just
That was
so
in class,
for the exams. Yeah. Then they shift towards standardization.
Okay.
And that's so I think in response we've kind of come to just use them interchangeably.
Right.
Okay. Even though it's not true.
Right. But that's in response to this whole CS, step two CS test.
Okay.
So I don't know. We'll see how that goes. They've got quite a few. signatures left, but if you, I suppose you could.
I'll sign it.
Okay.
If I have to.
Why not?
I mean, like.
You are a good person.
Like, both sides have a point, though, right? Like, the people with, I guess, step two are saying that we need to assess how you're able to communicate with patients. Mm-hmm. I think there's value in that. But also from the student side, you can't ask students who are living off of loan money to spend upwards of $2,000 to test for this. I mean, like, I think that's the issue, right?
I think the money is the issue.
If this were a free test administered at the site where students study, I think people have no problem with it.
It would probably be a lot
easier. And I mean, it's from a private company, so.
Is that?
Isn't it? Aren't the standardized tests run through private companies?
They probably, that wouldn't surprise me, but I guess I don't know for sure.
I think they are.
Okay.
And that's why this stuff gets so expensive.
Capitalism.
Because, I mean, think of the supply-demand dynamic in play for people who are halfway through their medical pay.
Well,
the demand is too high.
And you have to pay all of these patients to do the exams. You got to pay for the infrastructure, right. All that kind of stuff. I mean, there are definitely expenses associated with it, but, well, there you go.
Can we talk about the step one for, like, 5 minutes?
Yeah.
We can talk about step one.
No.
Overruled. Podcast ends.
Okay. So my grudge against that is, this semester we had MOHD 3, which for non-medical students is Mechanisms of Health and Disease. Sorry, part two. I meant not three. And the first part was dermatology. Then it was neuroscience. Or was it the other
one? It was neurology.
Neurology.
And then immunology.
Immunology, but immunology started with dermatology, or like a couple lectures of that. And the doctor who came in and talked to us about the lecture, she said she gave us a very general picture of what the conditions are, what the science is, and then she said, here's a bunch of cofactors and molecules that you don't need to know, but residents do need to know, and which is great. But then went on to immunology, and they're like a crap ton of IL factors and molecules and everything, which again, I am not interested in immunology, and I'm pretty sure I would never need to know those. For step one, instead of focusing on these small things like names of alphabets and numbers and other things, why don't the examiners focus on a big picture view? Like, a patient comes in and they have these conditions. Instead of knowing, well, this factor combines with this molecule to give this result, why don't you just look at the clinical picture instead of, a molecular picture? That's my rant.
They do that for step two. That's what step two is.
Right, but for step one,
I know a lot of people kind of.
It's and I don't know if this is true, but what I've decided in my general lack of knowledge about these sorts of things is that 99% of the time you don't need to know about pick your molecule ATP. Well,
ATP is pretty big. Let's go to TNF alpha.
It's all right. Yeah, you don't need to know.
There's infliximab. There's all these TNF alpha for immunotherapy.
But the point is, there are tons of examples.
Right.
These are just not the best.
It's logically not the ones that come to mind because those are the more relevant.
So I guess. But the point is that every once in a while, you could run across a patient where that pathway or whatever is actually very relevant. It's not going
to
happen often, but you should at least know.
But in derm, isn't like 80?
You don't know.
Forgive me, but isn't like 80% of the time you just treat with like a topical steroid?
I wouldn't know that.
That's the whole point.
No, I said derm as an example. In any specialty, especially in immunology, somebody who is going into the field of immunology or cancer, yes, I would expect them to know every single thing. If I'm going to them as a patient, I would expect them to know every single thing.
But at the same time, you don't expect them to know it going into a dermatology program, or else why are they going into the dermatology program? No, I'm agreeing with you.
Right, yeah.
Because that's really where they learn those things. So to even expect people to really remember the specific stuff from step one is kind of ridiculous. So everyone tells you in clinic, like a year or two after, is, oh, yeah, I forgot.
But what if they skipped over all that? What would be, if they skipped over all that?
I think
stuff.
It has value. No.
Where
I
would
don't
you?
Think they shouldn't skip over it, but it's overvalued.
Yeah.
Like, step one is the number one
yep.
most important factor for securing a residency spot.
Oh, yeah. That,
and
yeah.
I think that there's that's absurd.
Yeah,
that's
kind
the
of
case.
A problem. That's basically what that is. It's using an arbitrary metric to decide whether or not your competitive residency program will interview X number of people who.
Right.
Cross a certain threshold,
If it's just in a way becoming obsolete because historically having good memorization and recall was essential to being a physician, but nowadays we pull out our iPhone app and look it up. So all we need to know is when we
is when to look and where to look.
Yeah,
it's more important now that you know how to find out this information, right? You know,
honestly, it'd be more valuable for them to have like a standardized test on how we can answer these questions like with our iPhone.
Right.
But really.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And how well we can do and make the questions harder and more complicated.
But they allow
Android. But give us like a realistic that's a realistic way we're going to be able to operate now. And people who know how to Google things, that's like an actual skill. To know how to search things on the internet and find something quickly is more valuable a lot of times than being able to recall it with maybe 70% confidence, because you can't act on 70% confidence.
Yeah. I mean, I would ask the question, have they done studies where it shows people with higher STEB1 scores equal better doctors?
I think it shows the opposite.
They've done studies
and it has very little predictive
value. Okay, well, it's kind of like the MCAT then, right? I mean, you can have a high MCAT score.
The MCAT has very low predictive
and
value of
apparently that predicts whether you're doing well preclinically, but as far as after that, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if that's the case, why use it as a barometer for residency?
When it comes down to, like, how often do you hear, like, actual physicians in the hospital still bringing up their MCAT score, or, like, their STEM score?
Never. That would be pretty...
Maybe it's part of...
That would be pretty annoying.
Maybe it's part of the hierarchy, like, nope, I took STEP 1, you're gonna take
it kind of is, yeah. But even with that mindset, it's unfair to, like, place so much weight on it. Because I remember when I was studying for STEP 1, and it's nice in the sense that like it does kind of put things together and allow you to synthesize topics. But then in the back of your head, you're like, wow, like this is weighted so heavily. Like when I get my grade back, that's like, I bet I'm going to like feel very strongly about that grade. When I finally got it back, I actually found that I didn't really care.
Yeah.
Because after I took the exam, I'm like, you know what? Like, if I were to have studied any harder, that wouldn't improve me being a doctor at all. Yeah. So I'm glad I didn't study any more than I did. It was a much different response than I thought I'd have. I thought I'd look at my score and be either really proud of it or really upset and like really down on myself. But honestly, it was like, all right, that was kind of a crapshoot.
Nice like, coating
whatever.
Of apathy.
Well, if you're, you know, if your STEP score, Matt, Taz, if your STEP 1 score ends up getting you down and you find yourself alone in a room.
I hope not.
Right.
You find yourself alone in a room with your thoughts.
I see where this is going.
You know, and you have this desire to like electrocute yourself.
Sure.
Know that you're not alone.
Sure. we should all electrocute ourselves together.
Yes.
I disagree with that.
I disagree with that. I'm sorry.
We all die together.
Well, let me.
Which is sadder? I don't know.
Oh gosh.
Let me. I read this series of studies, in which they sought to decide whether people would enjoy spending 6 to 15 minutes in a room by themselves doing absolutely nothing but think, or whether they enjoyed doing mundane external activities more, and basically what they found is that many people preferred to give themselves electrical shocks on a voluntary basis rather than sit in a room alone.
That's the mundane task.
I don't think so. I had a little trouble parsing this out because I'm not a scientist.
So what's the age of the sample group, I would ask?
Let's see.
People like 18 to 24 maybe, who have no attention span and can't like be without their phones for like 2 minutes.
I don't think so, but I don't know. Anyway, let me tell you. There were two parts of the study. Part one, the participants sort of rated the pleasantness of some positive stimuli, like nice photographs, right? And some negative stimuli, like electrical shocks. And they also reported how much they would like to get paid, how much they would pay to experience or not experience those things again if they were given $5.
That's a lot of money.
So then, the part two, they got some instructions. They got some instructions to go into a room and just entertain themselves with their thoughts for about 15 minutes. And if they wanted, this is important. If they wanted, they could receive an electrical shock by pressing a button.
I would get at least one.
They chose And they were careful to say, you know, this is your choice. So it was entirely up to them. Many participants elected to receive the electrical shock over no stimulation other than thinking, especially dudes. 67% of men gave themselves...
There's a humor bias in there, too, though. Guys think it's funny if they're put in a room and someone asks if you can receive an electric shock, and you choose to. Like, that almost makes it worth it, besides any other deep psychological...
It's a common thought we all have.
Yeah. It's just like, this guy's going to think I'm crazy if I take, like, HX.
I mean, how many of you have put, like, a 9-volt battery on your tongue?
When I was a kid, I was, like, wandering around in my basement.
You haven't?
That's totally a thing.
I haven't done it either. Have you guys done
that? No, I have not.
Okay,
no.
Good. I'm not the only guy.
Well,
like, I considered
yes.
it. I
not a 9... Do... Well, yeah.
So you mean I'm the only one who's, like, putting 9-volt batteries on my tongue?
Maybe.
More Mark?
Yeah. Well, I've never done that.
Different eras, right, Dave?
Amy, you're a woman. You wouldn't understand, apparently, because 67% of men gave themselves at least one shock during the thinking period.
Very exciting.
I guess simply being alone with their thoughts for 15 minutes was so horrible.
See, I think that's
that they
the
would
wrong,
rather shock
I think
themselves.
That's the wrong conclusion.
So you think they're just...
Oh, I think that's complete bullshit. Yeah.
Say again, because I'm not sure I understand. Say again.
So they're interpreting the decision to receive a shock as like masochism. Like you want pain, I don't know, as in their interpretation, some outlet for like deep strife in you or sadness to some degree.
Well, I think so what they're think saying is they would rather you they would you they would the subjects would rather not think.
No,
but you're saying they're just trying to foil.
I think
the
they're in a room. No, I think they're in a room for 15 minutes, bored, and they see a little electric thing and they're curious. I think this is more an appeal to.
Well,
like
they know what the electrical thing does.
Yeah, right, but. I would do it, and I'm not sad.
Right.
But you and I both put 9-volt batteries on our tongues.
Right. And I'm still not depressed.
We have apparently a predilection for this.
Right. So I think that there are far too many confounding variables to draw any useful conclusions from that.
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying, if you find yourself in that situation, guys, right. know
Maybe.
That it's okay.
Yeah.
If you're
it
a woman,
needs more
I guess
research.
Not so much. You're a more reasonable section of the population.
Is there a percentage on the women? How much...
Let's see. 25% of women. Now, the interesting.
What was the
here's an interesting thing.
I'm sorry.
67.
Here's an interesting thing. If I understand this correctly, there was a range of 0 to 4 shocks. Among the participants
in 15 minutes.
And among the women,
probably
the range was 0 to 9.
Whoa!
Holy crap!
I'd like, I wonder what the standard
Talk
deviation is.
Talk about masochism.
Is. Some women really love it.
So what's the voltage on that shock?
I don't know. I doubt it's probably pretty low.
Because see, that's another question. Because if I were to go and shock myself just for fun, because I'm sitting in a room by myself for 15 minutes, and it didn't hurt that bad, I would totally
probably do it again.
Shock myself several more times.
I'm imagining. We should do this actually.
No, oh, gosh. No.
I'm imagining those dog collars.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
We should totally do that.
Oh gosh.
I used to play around with one of those with my friend all the time.
So you are not qualified to talk
right,
about this.
Right, I might be a bit of an outlier.
All right.
But here's the thing. So I have chronic back issues, and when sometimes like I have a lot of back issues, I would have somebody stand on my back. Now it's painful. I'm not saying it's not painful, but it's painful, and it feels good because the pain is getting out. You know what I mean?
Are there stiletto heels involved in this at
no.
all?
No.
Okay. Good.
No.
I just wanted to
no heels.
Check
just
that
just
out.
Regular feet.
Just want to make sure you weren't crazy. not that you know. Anyway.
Are you,
there's anything
are
wrong
you
with
judging
it.
Me, Dave? Just because I'm IMG.
Okay.
Yeah. First Pakistan. Now his outfit.
What is he doing here? Gosh.
No, but maybe it's one of those things where they tried the first time. Mm-hmm. They don't feel like horrible pain. They just feel like nice-ish. And they're like, you know what? It doesn't hurt. I can do it again. And they just keep on doing it.
So there's a cumulative effect, and then eventually you...
Right. And then it doesn't help with the women doing it like almost twice as much as men doing it, which...
Well, that was the range. I mean, it could have been one...
That's,
plus,
you know,
there's a safety
person.
Thing here, right? Like, this isn't quite humans in the wild. This is humans in a laboratory where they're like, hey, you can shock yourself,
if
just
you want
so
to.
You know.
Right.
So they know that whatever voltage is coming out of there isn't dangerous.
It's going to kill them, yeah.
So that will come in the wild thing, in our next episode.
Okay.
I've written that down. Amy, you can opt out of that show if you like.
Yeah. Can I do a personal ad right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, what?
If you want.
Sure.
My name is Amy Young, and this is for all the CCOM students that are in clerkships. I'm going back to clinic April 18th, and I'm terrified, and I have no friends in med school because they all graduated years ago.
Yeah.
Hey, you'll be with my classmates.
So if you see me,
say hi to
in the corridor, help me answer the question that the attending is asking me.
I heard her on the podcast.
And be my buddy. Thanks.
Thank you, Amy.
There's no interviews required. You can just be my friend on the spot.
Very good.
Thank you for sharing.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Let's.
I'm so desperate. Love me.
So there you go.
Please love me.
I got that.
We practice empathy statements, you know, with our simulated patients.
Please have empathy for me.
It's just like we kind of like went off that really quick.
Yeah.
That's really heartfelt. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we'll everyone in the hospital is going to see someone with Amy on their name tag. They're gonna be like, is that her?
Oh my god.
Do you want to make friends with the M1s or just the M2s and 3s and 4s?
Anybody on clerkship, you can commiserate.
So that's not us.
You will have a good choice with a lot of M2s. We will get there next year, but we'll help you.
Does a dress code not allow wearing buttons or something? Because you could like wear a button like please like me.
I think you could wear a button. But
so for my early clinical experience,
Can I just delete that whole thing? I shouldn't have done that.
No, I thought it was good.
It was good. I like that.
I think it's great.
It's here forever now. It's never gonna go away.
There, they're like, yeah, like I'm here to learn and I like gung-ho and blah blah. But the truth is, we all need buddies, right?
Absolutely,
we do.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, part of the thing that makes my guess is that part of the thing that makes med school that helps makes med school tolerable.
Yes, that's the right word.
Knowing that you're in it. With a group of other people who are experiencing
the same
thing.
We're all dying together with you.
I wasn't going to go that far because
I used to like ask classmates or people like in a year younger than me that I know are still studying. I'd be like, "Oh, how are classes going?" But then I'd ask that and be like, "I know the answer to that question." So I changed it to say, "How's surviving classes going?" Yeah. And people like that way more. Yeah. They're like, "Oh, you know, better." Because you ask anyone like, "How are classes going?" And they're like, good. And it's like, all right, they don't want to talk about that.
And just as a plug for buttons, I will say.
Because we need that.
We should have commercials. Each of the guests get their own commercial segment. Yeah.
I was going to say before, my ECE instructor, who is a neurologist, he wears a Yoda button. That's
early clinical experience.
Oh, okay. It's something you didn't have to go through.
So he's a neurologist. And his button says, it's a Yoda button. It says, may the force be with you. So I'm just saying you can wear a button.
So it can be done.
Is my plug. Right. That's all I'm saying.
Can I have a personal?
Please love me.
Can I do mine?
Okay.
I'm selling an Osprey backpack on Craigslist. If anyone's interested, just contact me. It's size extra large.
The personals ad section.
Dave, I'm so sorry.
Completely serious.
It's fantastic. We're providing a service here.
Right. Yeah.
Let's move on before everybody wants to do one.
Fair enough.
Hey, I'm the only one left.
And actually, this may help you, Amy, because we're going to revisit our favorite place on the internet, Yahoo Questions.
I love those.
I was wondering where that was going.
I can work on my clinical skills.
So this will work on your clinical skills. Just like pretend, if you like, that these are standardized patients.
That I'm so great with.
Let's start with this one.
Is it natural to eat pus from a pimple?
Oh my god.
No.
I think we need a definition of natural.
Now, look. What if this was a real patient? You can't be judgmental. What would you say?
I would ask why.
Are we supposed to be in patient mode right now?
Yeah,
or
let's pretend to be.
Are we in psychologist mode?
Let's pretend to be a real physician.
How does that make
physician.
You feel?
Tell me more.
Yes.
Is there a medical
open-ended
question? I know if you eat certain things, like if you have, what is it, pica? You know, that
what?
May be.
Yeah,
like
so pica is a disease where you eat inanimate objects. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that little kids usually? Or is it.
Or people that are anemic. Get it
right. It's
you
okay.
Certain.
I think
certain
it's. I think it's because like there's right, but I think it's because there's like iron and dirt. Like so when like you're anemic, it's something
you
want to
eat,
or you'll like try and eat anything to get iron. I don't know if that's true, but
I've heard the theory too.
Yeah,
that makes sense though.
I guess I don't know
if you get anything nutritional out of
and
pus.
Pregnant, well, you do get neutrophils,
but they're dead. But they're dead, so it doesn't.
But it does kind of have like a sweet sour taste.
How do you know that?
Hey, I have had my wisdom teeth removed, and anyone who's had their wisdom teeth removed knows that like there's like pus in the back. You have to rinse out with like a little syringe thing.
I have not had my wisdom teeth removed.
And it is so disturbing, but I know. know that taste.
Oh, God.
Does this person want a serious answer?
I'm just going to go with... Hold on.
Dave is spreading the plague.
You know, first I would ask why.
Yeah.
And then I would say, you know what? Go for it.
It's not going to hurt you.
YOLO.
Yeah.
I would let them know that other people might think it's disturbing. Because they probably deserve
well,
to
they're
know
asking
that it's
the
not
question,
socially
so
acceptable.
They're asking the question, so I'm pretty sure they...
I mean, if they're asking is it natural, I would say, honestly, it's probably not.
Yeah.
That being said, if it will not hurt you, yeah, probably.
There I
you
think go. That's a good answer.
All right, let's move on to our next important question.
If I don't have antibiotics, could I just eat moldy bread for a sinus infection?
Moldy bread?
Yeah.
For a sinus infection?
Yeah.
No.
Are those two different questions that you merged together?
No. No.
Go to the doctor.
Well, I mean, usually sinus infections are viral, aren't they?
Yeah, like 95%, I think.
So no and no.
Okay, there you go. Okay, asked and answered.
But you should still go to the doctor.
Yeah.
Because you want a proper evaluation.
All right, this one this should be interesting. Here we go.
I saw this post from a factual account about the danger triangle, an area on your face you should not touch. Do you know about it? Or is it a myth? Could I die if I pop a pimple in that area?
Danger triangle?
No, yes, no. No, I don't know about it. Yes, it's a myth. No, you won't die.
Like, we're M1s. I've never heard of this. Have you heard of this?
Actually, no, we did talk about
this. Did we talk about this?
Did you really?
Did we?
An anatomy that...
It's real,
because anatomy are something that all these vessels and veins are connected to each other, so there's no... Like, if you pop a pimple here in that area somewhere, I don't know if you can see me. I'm pretty sure you can see me on the radio, but, like, basically it's around your nose and your lips and eyes. And if you pop a pimple here, the danger is that the infection can spread to your brain and the rest of the face. Yeah. Now, this was Dr. Can we say the name of the doctor?
Sure.
So this was Dr. Pizzamente, for anatomy professor. He didn't specify about dying.
So he's a PhD.
So yeah, he knows what he's talking about. So I wouldn't say it's a myth, but I don't know if you will die from it.
So
must be if you're like severely, severely immunocompromised or something.
Yes.
I actually may have. So many years ago, I got what I've come to call my life-threatening pimple. And
tell us more.
Well, I will. I did not eat the pus, but it was gigantic. And my father, physician's assistant, told me that I should go and see somebody. I didn't have insurance. I should go and see somebody because of its location. And I could get an infection. Maybe is that must be what he was referring to.
Where was it? I was going to ask.
I can't remember. It was like basically on my face. It was okay. Giant. I think it was in my jawline I can't remember, but it was huge. To the point
did
where
did they drain it?
Well, I didn't have insurance, so eventually it went away. So
I think immunology, we did talk about, I guess, the nose being a way to pass through the blood-brain barrier.
That's true.
Is that
yeah.
correct?
Like that was Dr. Sipla and Dr. Hartman. Immunology were, but yeah.
Well, one of the big dangers there is that on your skull, there's the perforated part of the bone, the cribriform plate,
mm-hmm. yep.
right at the base there, and I think that's yeah. where the idea is that it can penetrate in
yep.
through.
And
that's when you get mucor with diabetic patients, like there's a major risk that it can go through the cribriform plate and into the brain, and then you get a brain infection with a fungus, and it's nasty.
And
I might have been too far away for that.
That's all right. For people who don't know what the cribriform plate is, it's like just a plate full of holes
mm-hmm.
in above your nose. That's it.
Right.
Nothing too fancy.
Okay.
It's like
that's
a sponge.
Interesting, though. I'd never heard about the triangle of what did they call it?
The danger triangle.
Danger triangle.
Danger yeah. triangle.
Danger triangle.
I guess it's probably right around the curve.
Are we allowed to Google stuff here, like true doctors?
Yes.
No, this is step one.
Do that right now.
Okay, this is step one.
While you do step that, one rules. You can't.
While you do that, feel free to break in with your results. But I'm going to move on to this next question.
Sure, go ahead. Yes.
Here we go.
Can crying cause a brain hemorrhage? I'm really scared. Cause when you cry, your head feels all pressured and stuff, and I'm just really worried.
Aw, that's sad. That's not
yeah.
funny.
I don't know why
no,
I'm
I don't,
laughing.
I didn't do this to be funny, because I was thinking that my head often feels like it's going to explode, and it could be because, you know, I'm pissed off. I'm upset. Maybe I'm crying. You know, and I wonder, is this like a sinus thing, like when you feel this way? Is this a sinus thing?
Yeah.
That's pretty
yep.
much what I've
mm-hmm.
decided.
Yeah.
But there are, like, do we know what the origin of headaches are?
Not really.
I don't think we know, right?
Well,
And I get headaches after I'm
there's
like,
different etiologies, right?
Like a sinus headache. I mean, we pretty much know that that's well inflammation in your sinuses, though. For instance. But then there's other ones.
They used to think that it had to do with expanding and contracting of the blood vessels, but I guess that's since been kind of fallen out of favor. Now everyone
it's so weird
know,
that
really.
It's so weird to me that such a common malady is like
yeah, but it's the brain, like, which we know not, least about
is not well understood. We think it's the brain.
It's in the brain, and I think that's
so I thought brains didn't have nerves, sensory nerves in them.
Well, you're talking about the perception of pain, right?
Yeah, but I'm saying that the vessels or whatever's going on is like is located within the brain.
Think of if you have pressure on your brain, like there's edema or fluid above outside the brain, it's going to put pressure on the brain. The brain cannot expand. Now, the brain does not have sensory pain neurons, but the pain can be detected because you have headaches and you have, you know, those migraines sort of thing.
So there's a surround, I mean, there's, you know, things that surround the brain.
Yeah, and that's the source of most headaches.
It could be that the vasculature has some innervation too. I don't know. Right.
No. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Anyway, to answer her question,
go and look this up before your clinicals because you know one of those things you're going to be asked about.
I'm concerned that maybe she's having I just assume that was a she?
You can assume whatever you like.
Oh my gosh,
no,
I'm so
sexist. It was a woman's voice.
Oh, okay, good.
I don't know if that means
are all these voices like women's voices?
I chose randomly among some voices.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just concerned that she might be having an anxiety attack.
Okay.
And that concern or that worry would just be feeding it. So we'd want to just help get her calmed down.
Like most of these questions, you need to ask more questions, basically.
Right. And I mean, the biggest thing is, like, I guess to some extent, if you're crying a lot and you're stressed, that can lead to increased risk of hypertension, which puts you at greater risk of just any vascular disease.
But so don't tell her that when she's freaking out.
Right.
So it's probably more of, like dealing with her anxiety, like you were saying.
I do have this thing where I'll say sometimes, like, I'm so mad I'm going to have an aneurysm. And I don't think that's evidence-based at all.
Angry.
And I don't think it would
be
that
seems very reasonable.
I've never heard that saying.
No, I just say it.
Yeah, the only thing I've ever seen with, like, vessels and actually, like, transient emotion has been when people pop a blood vessel in their eye.
Oh.
That's the only time I've ever heard of that, like, actually. Like, I've never heard of someone getting so angry they actually plop a blood vessel in their brain or, like, in a... It could happen.
Yeah,
I don't
who
know.
Knows, yeah.
But you hear about an eye. I remember my cousin would get so angry. He'd just, like, bubble up and just, like, grunt and, like, pop a blood vessel in his eye.
Wow. He sounds sweet.
Yeah, he's a nice kid.
No, the only thing I know is the anatomically and physiologically, when your blood pressure goes up, that's the only danger there is for popping a blood vessel in your eye or in your brain or like a hand.
If you have heart disease that's not treated, you could go to cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
But, you know, theoretically, the brain's blood pressure should be way better maintained than the rest of the body. So I think it's unlikely.
It's not going to happen the first time.
Unlikely for a single
response. Yeah,
it's going to happen like repeated events.
That sounds fantastic.
Okay, great.
What did you say?
You guys sound fantastic. I'm buying the whole thing. Here we go. Next question.
Yesterday, I was messing around with my mom and she started tickling me. I jumped up and accidentally elbowed her boob. She looked really hurt and was worried that she might get breast cancer. Can punching someone in the boobs cause breast cancer?
I don't think I don't think so.
No,
I think your mom's just really trying to guilt you.
Well, I'm going to assume that getting elbowed in the boob is going to hurt. And
I don't think the mom said you've given me breast cancer, though. Like,
I
think
know
this
of
is
any
the person.
You don't know that.
Trauma and breast cancer and cancer in general.
All right. I might skip this one. I'm not really sure about it.
We're going down, Dave.
I will. Okay.
Should we end the podcast now?
No. let's see. How about? I'll give myself time to think about this one. We'll go on to this next one.
Is getting cancer getting cheaper or more expensive? Your thoughts?
That's a good question.
I don't
actually
get the question.
The cost of treating cancer.
Oh.
I mean, my first thought was like, well, it's pretty much free. But yeah, I think they mean more. Like, more of the treatment,
not the acquisition.
Yeah, sure.
It's probably getting more expensive. It's probably getting more expensive because treatments are becoming more targeted.
Yeah.
So they're going to be more expensive just to administer, like, the pharmacologic agents. But also, especially with the case of leukemias, people are living longer and they're able to live with some cancers as like a chronic disease. That's a great thing, but that probably means, you know, if you're treating someone over a 10-year period versus a 3-month period, there's going to be higher costs. I think if you, I think that's the wrong question to ask if you're a patient.
Sure. Because you need to get treated no matter how much it costs.
Right, right. Yeah.
And there's a lot of reasons why you might, you know, seek treatment.
And I guess the goal would be to reduce the cost of treatment versus doing a comparative before, after. I don't know.
That sounds very reasonable.
I'm going to stop talking.
I'm gonna ask this question. Maybe I'll delete it later. I don't know.
Ooh, this is a wild one.
Yep.
On the edge.
Here we go.
Does masturbating after touching rabid dog cause rabies? I washed my hands after touching the suspect dog, but still afraid of contamination?
So my first question, like, how...
Many questions.
Right. So as an M1, we haven't really studied rabies,
no,
have we?
Not like, yet,
so
no.
So how does rabies infect someone? And that's
it's
my first
blood,
question.
I think
it's
to be
saliva.
You have to be bit...
Is it fluids
like
or...
Like a bloodborne,
I think it's
yeah.
Bloodborne, okay.
So
I think this...
it's a very delicate question.
I would say...
this
most
sounds
probably
like it might
not.
Be like a... I would talk to the patient more, but I'm wondering if this is like an obsessive compulsive like cleanliness type question. Although there is a rabid dog involved, which
anytime there's a rabid dog involved,
that's not the involvement of rabid dogs is not something I usually associate with masturbation.
Right.
But,
you
know, it's just
so taking
masturbation can happen.
Taking masturbation out of the equation. So like, let's say you were like
yes,
laying on the ground. Well, no, just like, okay, let's say a rabid dog was standing above you and like saliva went from his mouth into your mouth.
God.
So just the orally speaking.
Let's not talk about that either.
Okay.
No, no, but kidding. I understand what you're getting at.
Yeah,
that's
I mean,
the relevant question.
Right, would that cause rabies?
Well, you could go get
actually,
vaccine,
that's
right?
Different because that's entering the digestive tract.
Mm-hmm.
As
okay.
Opposed
the
to
the
let's say it dripped into your eye.
Like penile orifice.
Right.
Well, it could be a woman, actually.
Right, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. It would actually be more dangerous than a woman due to the shorter urethra, I would
yep.
think.
Oh.
Yeah. No, that actually makes sense.
But I don't think I don't
think
there's really
do you have a swelling in your brain vessels?
If they wash their hands.
My aneurysm.
I think there would be low risk even and maybe possible if they didn't wash their hands, and with washing their hands, I would think essentially no risk.
So can you get a rabies vaccine like after being let's say bit or exposed in some way, like would that work?
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You can get
you're
it.
Actually recommended to use it even if you have the slightest chance, because it hides around until it's like in your brain.
If you live in Firo on the third floor,
you're gonna get rabies.
Well,
where is this going?
This is the medical.
There's a rabid dog that lives on the third floor. We use 2, 4, 5, and 6. 3's on quarantine.
So they're the medical fraternity. It's an old house with an attic, and I guess bats could get in there.
Oh, sure. I caught a bat at AKK, the other fraternity, actually.
I mean, if you wake up, if you've been asleep and you wake up and there was a bat in your room, which I guess is a thing at Viro.
Holy crap.
Then you have to go to student health to get rabies vaccine, because I guess they can bite you in your sleep and you not know it.
Yeah, I would do that for sure, go get a rabies vaccine.
I feel like that might be something that would wake me up.
Not me. I know my sleep.
You know what? When someone has...
I guess if you've had something to drink, maybe before bed.
When someone has later stage rabies, you know what the number one behavioral sign is?
No.
No.
Animals and humans, when they have rabies and it's like really late, like this
like
person really needs help.
Like aggression?
No,
like
actually.
Old Yeller?
Aggression is part of it. But actually the number one most specific one is a distinct fear of water.
Oh yeah, wow. I've heard that.
Huh. And that they think explains the frothing of the mouth is that they've actually been avoiding water and that it's really dry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. What would be the evolutionary or the
That's I think just a virus manipulating like psychological
like that.
Pathways
oh,
at that
yeah,
point
yeah.
due to infection.
Oh, what's the name
that's
of the
pretty
virus?
Much when it's gotten to your central nervous system.
But in many cases
like
you can sort of tease out a possible reason why that might be the case. Is there
Not that I know of.
Okay. I don't know the reason, but I'd like to add another story to this. I don't know if you guys know about this virus that infects cat brains and... It
mice.
Reproduces in the cat intestines and infects mice brain.
That is jacked up.
Do you know that what I'm talking
no.
about?
I hate mice.
Cats have crazy.
I forgot the name of the virus, but Dr. Sipla, neuroanatomy professor, he talked about this, and he says, so it is actually like brain control. The virus will infect the mice In the intestines, and because they eat, you know, cat poop, I guess, and then it'll migrate to the brain eventually, mm-hmm. and then it will make sure, like, you know, the brain, the mice, it will try to, you know, run away from cat urine, mm-hmm. but when the virus infects it, it actually gets attracted to cat urine, so it'll hang around cat urine.
I've heard this. I think he told us the same story. Yeah.
It becomes sexually attracted to cat urine.
And then
using toxoplasmosis, is it?
Yes, okay. That's what it is.
There we go. Oh,
nice. Yes, we didn't know the name.
Coming
Dave.
In hot.
Right here.
Yeah.
There we go.
Thank you very much. I think I'm going to end the show on that note.
Wait. I have a good one. Last one that's related.
Go ahead.
Is that on that same line, even crazier is in bugs. Bugs will get infected with a type of fungus like ants, and will make them climb to the top of a blade of grass, like only during the nighttime, and hang there because they're the transitional stage for this fungus or virus, I forget what it is, parasite that needs to be eaten by like a bat or something. So they mind control the ants to go out specifically at night and hang from the ends of leaf blades.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy Match Day.
Good luck to you all.
Never stop dreaming.
There's always hope.
And it's not a pint of great beer.
That's good.